Hi there, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Volk Knowledge. You're here with me today, Sam, and today I am joined by Dr. Jasmine Scarlett, who is a historical and social volcanologist and also geo video game expert. Hi, Jasmine. Thanks for joining us today.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us today. There's so many things I feel like we could talk about today. But just before we get into all of that, it'd be really great to hear about some of your background, what got you interested into this field, because you've come through a slightly different route than I think a lot of people would think is conventional for people who are involved in geology and volcanology. So it'd be great to hear more about that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so I'm a little bit different in that actually I've come into volcanology via geography. So I did my undergraduate at Coventry University in geography and natural hazards. So there I was learning a mixture of physical and human geography topics as well as disaster management. So I was taught by a very diverse department in terms of what they research and whatnot. I definitely was very hooked on the natural hazards component. That's particularly why I wanted to do this course. Because I was really fascinated about when we learned about natural hazards in school in for GCSE and A-level. And I was like, this is really cool, I want to do more. So it's how I ended up choosing this particular course. When I got to the end of that course, it was a four-year course, so I did a placement year as a teaching assistant in Wales. That was very interesting. But I got to the end of the course, and like some students, I didn't want to go into the real world of work. I wanted to continue learning. So I particularly was, this was the point where I was like really particularly interested in volcanoes. Because what we learned about volcanoes, it wasn't actually as much compared to other hazards, because there actually wasn't really any volcanologists in the department. There was one particular person who sort of like, it's their interests, it's not actually their core focus of research. We mainly learned about like flooding and stuff like that, because obviously that's the main hazards that are impacted in the UK. But I particularly was interested in volcanoes. So I was looking around at other courses, and then I spoke to my family as well. I was like, what do you think? And then my mum just said, oh, talk to your granddad because he grew up on the volcanic island in the Caribbean. I'm like, what? So this is the first time. I was 21 years old. And I never heard about this before. And it's a thing in particular in Afro-Caribbean cultures. Like, if you don't ask, they don't tell. So this was the situation here. It's like, I never asked my granddad where he grew up, basically, because he came over here during the Windrush generation. So I didn't know anything about the Caribbean in that perspective. So I spoke to my granddad, and he was like, oh, yes, I come from a place called St. Vincent and the Grenadines. And there's this volcano called La Soufriere. And it erupted last in 1979. And then I spoke to other like family and family friends as well, because quite a lot of our family have come from St. Vincent and have stayed over here. And I was like, well, this sounds really cool. Like, I want to learn more about this volcano, because in school you're taught mainly about Soufriere Hills volcano in Montserrat, because obviously that's the most recent eruption. But you don't really hear about the other volcanoes in the Caribbean. And I was like, well, I'm very intrigued by that. So that led me eventually to choosing to do volcanology and geological hazards at Lancaster University. So I wanted to basically up my knowledge in physical volcanology, essentially, to really understand, one, just how volcanoes in general, how they work, and then two, how La Soufriere works, because I was just really intrigued. Physical volcanology. So this is the first point I was really introduced to geology, and turns out not good at it at all. which is fine, you know, you have the things that you're not good at. But it was very interesting to learn anyway, in that respect. And like, one thing I did learn from that is there's different ways to be a volcanologist, I learned, because I was in a small cohort. There was like 9 of us, and all our backgrounds were different. There were a couple that came from a physics background, someone who came from like a maths background, someone else who came from a geography background. Two were retired people, so they were just doing it for the hell of it. And I just really found it fascinating that actually there's different ways you could actually learn about volcanoes and how you can research them. And when it came to the dissertation project, this is really, I started to carve a niche for myself and being like a social archaeologist. So as most places that do dissertations, usually lecturers propose projects that they're currently working on and wish for assistance from students. And I looked at them all and they were like physics, maths, computer modeling, chemistry, all the stuff I couldn't do, basically. And I was like, this is not going to go well. But then I started to think about actually what I learned in undergrad. And I really particularly enjoyed a module called Community Resilience, which was a final year module. So this is where we learn about resilience and like the dynamics between like how you prepare communities to face natural hazards and disasters and stuff like that. And then thinking of like the experiences for my family and family friends with La Sofrere in 1979, I was like, I want to learn, I want to take that kind of angle. So that, that led me to creating my own project on volcanic risk perceptions of La Sofrere. I was very fortunate to actually do my master's dissertation to go to St. Vincent. The only concern that I had to get through the risk assessment was going just before the hurricane season. that was the only thing. But I had to choose a really particular window where I could go, because they were pretty much I know St. Vincent compared to other Caribbean islands, they don't experience hurricanes, but you never know. So we kind of we're not sure. So I managed to negotiate to make sure I get all my assignments done, because it was a taught master's. So make sure I get all my assignments in and everything like that before I go. So I managed to go a month before the rainy season started. yes, but I spent a month there because I was doing questionnaires and interviews, which for me was interesting because I hadn't really done that much during my undergrad, because I did do human geography, but I hadn't actually done that before. So that was an eye-opening experience. And I managed to get two supervisors, one a physical volcanologist interested in risk, and the other person was a human geographer that's interested in governance. Because my particular project, I was interested in the connections between how people perceive the volcano and how that connects to the their preparedness and their trust in of local authorities and stuff.
And particularly for small island communities, it's such an important aspect. This landscape control is their everyday life. There's not much where else you can go that you're not always observing this volcanic edifice in your backyard. So it's such an important part of people's daily lives.
Absolutely. And what I found from that project was that the main thing was that there's like a generational gap in knowledge, bearing in mind this was in 2014 I did this, and so there's a generational gap in knowledge where the older members of the population, they had experiences of 1979 and that drove their knowledge of the volcano. Whereas young generations of students and whatnot, they were learning the scientific knowledge at school, but they didn't have the experience. And I've come to argue in like my research that both knowledge and experience is very important how to be prepared for a volcanic eruption or any natural hazard in general. So that was very fascinating. And I got to, that was like where my family's from, and that's the first time I've been. So it was just really nice to get to know the people and the island where my granddad grew up, and meet relatives as well. It turns out that, I've got lots of cousins because I'm part of a big family called the De Freitas. And there's a lot of them on the island. So I was almost essentially always bumping into cousins. It was very interesting. so that was cool. I did that dissertation. I got a very good mark out of it. And I was pretty much praised for the fact that I created this project myself and I drove it myself. And the course director, I'm sure he won't mind if I name drop him, Hugh Tuffin. Excellent volcanologist, great guy. he was the one's like, you're really good at this, you should do a PhD. So it was his encouragement that actually was like, okay, I feel like I could do a PhD, sure, why not? Because I was not ready to go into the real world of work. So I was like, why not? I'll do some more research. So that eventually led me to doing the PhD at the University of Hull. And this is where I really carved a niche, because I was not, for me, I was not done with researching La Soufrière and St. Vincent. So I was in a fortunate position where I could actually create my own project around a theme and a topic that the supervisors proposed. So for me, because one of the supervisors was actually an environmental historian, I was like, well, what does perceptions of this volcano look like in the past? And that essentially was how I kind of stumbled into historical geography in terms of how people perceived the landscape in the past and how they perceived the volcano in the past. And that led to a whirlwind adventure of going to loads of archives in the UK and in the US and in St. Vincent. And also doing interviews with people in St. Vincent of what they remember when the 1979 eruption happened and what they did in response. Because I was interested, again, in a national and also kind of like a localized view of it all.
Yeah, so a real compilation of different data sources. I think so frequently when people think, you know, volcanology, you imagine that person going there sampling the lava and putting it into a bucket, or the soul who's rappelling down into some crater. But there's so many different aspects to this, and as you say, you've got personal experience, you've got the historical records and archives when we don't have those individual stories to hear from through interviews or people living today. And then you've also got the physical scientific record. And so being able to bring all those together is something quite unique, and it builds probably a better picture, an understanding of systems and how it impacts people now and how it's impacted people in the past and what we can then learn about going into the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what's interesting is actually my oral history actually matched very well with the geological history. So the geological maps of St. Vincent and the volcanic hazard map of St. Vincent, it actually matched almost identically to the hazards that were described by eyewitnesses in, so I looked at three eruptions, 1812, 1902 and 1979. For me, I really had to learn how they were describing things, because it was mainly based on descriptions of what they smelled, what they touched, what they heard, and through my scientific interpretation, I managed to deduce which hazard was what and where it went, and I produced my own maps from that, and they pretty much was an overlay of the current volcanic hazard map. So it's it complements one another, and I did find things that you can't find in geological record because it's a tropical island, so things get eroded quite quickly. So it's not preserved in geological record anymore, but it's preserved in the archival record.
Fantastic. Do you think were those records particularly well kept? Were they good historical records, or did you find there was a lot of gaps and you had to really, really search for the data in there?
It depended what I was looking for. Some were quite good, some of them were not so good. And one thing that I questioned a lot, because obviously I was thinking about the social kind of aspects of it, is that it was written mainly by one type of person. So for 1812, it was white colonial elite men. In 1902, it had a little bit more voice of the farmers who were descendants of emancipated slaves, but still, it was still dominated by the white voice. And for me, I was society, the St. Vincent Society is not just that. So I was like, where are the women? Where are the children? Where are the disabled? Where are the slaves? Where are the black people? I was really questioning that. And this is where my third supervisor helped with that, because she's a historical and cultural geographer who specializes in feminist geographies. And then she was like, well, why don't you use feminist theory to try and like acknowledge that gap and then also find ways to address that? So my project was quite unusual that I used feminist theory as well to underpin my methodology and to really, really be critical in the data and the voices I was using and essentially being upfront and like, this is only one side of the story. There are so many other stories out there that we just don't have because their voices were either silenced or oppressed or suppressed. And, you know, so it was a very it was definitely like the volcano was kind of like, it became like the volcano was kind of like in the background of my thesis. And it was mainly talking about like social issues that was like, look, because of these social issues related to each time period, this really drove how people understood the volcano because people were getting different knowledge and like forming their own knowledges and like how that impacted like the economy and like it was a wild ride.
Wow, yeah, because as you say, you've got and hazard is one thing, like there's always this definition that's embedded into our head early on in geology, natural hazard geography degrees about the difference between hazard and risk. And so in this case, your hazard is what's physically being produced by the volcano itself. So that's your lava flow, your ash. But then the risk side of it is felt differently amongst every community, and particularly in such a juxtaposed environment, as you say, between the colonial and the more local native island culture. So being able to bring both of those stories into one framework is the best way to actually perceive, well, what was the impact? Because impact is felt very differently from an affluent dominating community as opposed to, as you say, more local communities that are relying on subsistence farming. So it's just a really, really fascinating take.
Vulcan Knowledge is supported by Geology for Global Development. It's a UK-based charity which champions the role of geology in sustainable development. Their aim is to mobilise and reshape the global geology community to help deliver the UN Sustainable Development Goals. You can find out more about the work of GFGD by visiting their website www.gfgd.org or following them on social media.
Did you find that there were many other studies that had this kind of approach, whether it was through other island cultures? I guess there's not many other places in the world where you can produce these kinds of similar studies.
Here's the thing, like, in my conclusion of the thesis, I said that European colonialism happened for 400 years. There's definitely bound to be volcanoes that erupted in 400 years in occupied colonies. So what's not to say that we can't do that? Of course, it's not just British Empire, there's the Spanish Empire, there's the French Empire, and those locations, they had volcanoes on them, and they did erupt. So it's a very, at the moment, in volcanology, because it's being done outside of volcanology, particularly in historical geography field, in volcanology, it's not really done much to have that historical and social lens, but outside the discipline, it is being done. I'm like, the world is our oyster here. Like, because archives, like, there's definitely one thing I say is, like, Europeans, they definitely love to characterize and, like, put things in archives just to gather dust. It's like, well, it's all there. It's all there already. Like, you just need to go and get permission to access it if it's, like, a special kind of, like, embargo. Because obviously some, for example, if it's, like, governmental records, obviously they have, they can't be released for a certain number of years. I think in the UK it's about 50 years. I can't remember. I think so for like, for example, some stuff on St. Vincent is just being released now because it's just gone past 50 years or something like that. So sometimes you have to like be aware that some of these things are like they're classified and you have to wait for a number of years before they come available. But if we're talking about 400 years ago, like early kind of like empire, that stuff is available to the public because they're in public archives, essentially. Some might be in private collections, but it's there.
the access is there. Yeah, and then those bridges have to be made between, as you said, the social scientists, the historians, and the physical scientists to bring those stories together. So wow, and then timely for the end of your thesis, Le Soufrière decided to erupt, and in a combination of styles seen from the previous eruptive activity as well. So how was that being able to see what you'd gathered of information over the past 200 years of eruptive activity, and then to see this situation play out?
It was surreal. When I first noticed that, you know, the Seismic Research Center, who's in charge of monitoring the English-speaking Caribbean, when I saw like the Facebook message saying, "Oh, there's been confirmation that there's actually a effusive eruption taking place, that there's a lava dome forming," I like did a double take like at my phone. I was like, "Is this for real? Are they just playing us around? Like, is the volcano playing me around?" Like, I really could not believe it. And then it happened, like, it was confirmed that it started at the end of December last year. And I was literally there as well. Like, I said to myself, in a pandemic, come on. Like, I was just like, come on. Like, come on. St. Vincent's going through enough as it is. So, like, for me, when I first came across it, it was like, this can't be happening. But once it, the reality set in, it's like, okay, this is happening. Because I'm aware that social media is like a very, very strange beast when it comes to crises in general, particularly volcanic crises. I made the Seismic Research Center, particularly the communication branch, aware that, is it okay that on your behalf I like reinforce your messages or what you're trying to say and whatnot. And basically I tried as quickly as possible to identify myself on Twitter that I have done research on this volcano and I can answer questions, because the Seismic Research Center quite rightly would have been busy, so they couldn't always answer those questions, particularly on social media when people want an answer straight away.
And the chatter is there, and then somebody says one thing and then it devolves from there, and the misinformation can spread quite quickly. So yeah, it's a really fantastic effort that you put into all of that communication.
It was like, I wanted to do this because, of course, like, I understand that people want to know what's going on. At the same time, it was draining on me because I did not have a job. So I was like, look, I'm doing this voluntarily. Like, I could technically just not do this, but I just felt like it's my, essentially my civil duty that I had to do this. It's like, well, I have studied this volcano for like, what, six, seven years. So I was like, well, I am an expert on it. So I was like, well, I guess I have to. So yeah, I did what I thought was right, and that was to identify myself and be like, hey, I am an expert on this. If you have questions, please do answer. Particularly as well, I knew there were like some Vincentians that were following me on Twitter, and quite a lot of people in the other islands, neighboring islands as well, I knew had some of those Caribbean followers. So I was like, well, these are the most important people I need to reach out to. So let me focus my attention on that. And then, of course, in the UK, we have quite a large Caribbean diaspora here. So that led to like doing like radio interviews, particularly to a dominant black population that listened to those radio shows. TVs, interviews for Caribbean mostly. So I did TV interviews for St. Vincent, for Jamaica, for Trinidad and Tobago, because they're the ones that needed it the most. Yeah, I was just like, well, I got to do my bit. Like, this, it's like one of those kind of like unwritten kind of like jobs a volcanologist ends up doing, is if your volcano is erupting, you're going to be involved in communicating about it. So like, for example, with like La Palma at the moment, luckily I was like, well, actually, I don't actually know anything about La Palma other than it has a volcano. So I've managed, I had, I had been getting like media requests, interview requests. I was like, unfortunately, I'm not the best person to speak to, but I know someone who does. So I just passed on the expertise, like, because like I can't be an expert of all volcanoes, as much as I would love to. I can't be an expert for all of them, so I was happy to pass on the burden to someone else. But it's been a wild ride.
You really, really had a fantastic contribution to so many people that were wanting information about this. And from your perspective, having looked back through the history of the eruption, that gives you the opportunity to educate people about whether they're on the island or they're elsewhere in the Caribbean or back here in the UK, to educate them about more of the island's history and how this volcanic centre has played into the lives in society over on St. Vincent and on nearby islands as well. Like, the impacts were felt, I think most of the ash traversed over to Barbados in the east. So...
And yeah, like, unfortunately, Barbados always gets it. Like, even 1812, they got it. 1902, they got it. 1979, they got it. So that was, like, definitely an important thing. Like, that came up in my thesis, and, like, I had a whole section about where the ash went, like, across, you know, the colonies. Barbados, unfortunately, always got it. So... I was like, oh, they have such bad luck. It's because of the wind direction, because the wind direction just, it's an easterly wind. So that's why they mainly get the ash.
So from this now, are there other directions, other places, other past eruptions that you're thinking, we can take this technique, this method that we've put together between social volcanology, historical and physical, and to be able to apply that to other historical events that we know comparatively less about?
So for me personally, I like to focus more on marginalised communities because they're the ones that feel it the most. So I particularly would say that, well, we got the whole of the Caribbean there. There has been recorded activity in the historical record, whether it's an actual eruption or it's like a swarm event or something like that, there's those opportunities. But I think, well, anywhere that was colonized, which is a lot of places, and basically there definitely will be gaps in the archival records in terms of who is not there being talked about. So that's definitely one thing. When I was teaching, I would tell the class, and I even, like, when I last taught, so I used to teach in what you call geographies of risk. One of the seminars, I used the pandemic as an example, and I used the communications being brought out by the UK government, English government, may I add. And I said to people, okay, watch this. Tell me who is it for, and then who is missing from that message. And I picked one of the earlier kind of like communications about it, and like where they were like give me feedback, and I like mentioned, guys, have you noticed there's no subtitles and there's no like captions, live captions? You're missing people who are hard of hearing. And then I talked about how are they going to get information about that? Is it people in their household that's going to tell them what has been said? What are they going to likely do? They're probably going to summarize it in some way, so some of that information might get lost. And of course, that person is going to have their own interpretations of it. And of course, they're going to feed it on to the person who's hard of hearing. And that means they might be missing some vital information. So kind of like that. So basically think of, who is it being, who is in that message, and then who's missing from that message? And it's the people that are missing from that message is then who you should target, because they're the people that don't get the attention that they need to understand how to live with risk and with hazards, because their voices are not there, and voices are important to understand how we can cope with any kind of hazard.
Yes, exactly. There's so much to be learned from incorporating every voice, every experience, but also to make sure we focus on the ones that are most impacted, but as you say, that may not necessarily actually have that voice or that platform to be able to convey their experience. And I think it's something which is just very humbling about how nature and volcanoes and many other geologic processes just impact so many different communities in so many different ways across the world. So there's no one method you can take of, okay, this is how you prepare in the case of a volcanic eruption or another geohazard event. Every single location and place has to be individually assessed to make sure that we're approaching this in the right manner, based on past experience and current experience and the people and the way society works in those individual places. It's a really, really a commendable thing you're doing in science to really push this new way of thinking about hazard science forward. Well, I feel like we could always keep talking about more and more, and I hope that we will have a chance to do this again. But what I want to finish up with is, what is your most memorable volcano-related experience, if you have one, that you can choose?
Okay, so yeah, so I had several, but I'm going to choose actually. So it was to do when I was in St. Vincent, and it's the third time I climbed the volcano. And the reason why I like this experience is because I wasn't alone doing it. So like previous times I had family friends that took me up, which was obviously really nice in itself. But I was with colleagues, other people who were researching the volcano at the same time, and also locals, because this was during Volcano Awareness Week. So before the eruption that took place this year, and there would always be kind of like field trips by local, by members of the Seismic Research Center that would take groups of locals up to the volcano to teach about the volcano. And it's quite a hike. It's about 3 hours long, and it's through rainforest as well, so it can get quite humid and quite hot quite quickly. So you have to set off quite early to beat like kind of like the midday sun or whatnot. And I actually have a physical disability, and it's a mobility disability. So it's quite hard for me to climb a volcano, but of course I'm stubborn and I love volcanoes, so I'm going to do it anyway. There was about 40, 50 people. I was like the last person to reach the top, and like near, there was like the last ridge, and like someone came down and was like, Jasmine, you got to get here quick. You got to get here quick because it's completely clear. There's no clouds. You got to get here. I was like, okay, I can do it. I can get here. So like last push. Got up there, and just like the view was just breathtaking, like, and like just so clear, like you could see the 1979 lava dome just there, local funeral activity, just the greenery and like the blue skies. And I was like of course I was like out of breath, but at the same time my breath was taken away even more by the view. And I was like, that was just worth the suffering that I went through to get to the top. And so people were like, yeah, you know, you reached the top, look at this view. And just like it was just so, I love that moment so much. Just
a very rewarding and a grueling experience.
Yes. Yeah, I got back down to the bottom and just slept for the rest of the day.
Well, absolutely fantastic. I really want to thank you for joining us today and sharing your stories, your experience, and how your research is just kind of changing the way we think about current activity, past activity, and how we can move that forward to thinking about future eruptions. So thank you so much for joining us today, Jasmine. Anything that you've that we've talked about today, we'll have in links in the descriptions on the website. So however you're watching or viewing this podcast, you'll be able to see some of the things that Jasmine has talked with us about today. So Jasmine, I really hope we get a chance to chat again at some point, because there are many other opportunities and some very different avenues for us to talk about. So
yep.
We will save that, I will say, for another time.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Jasmine.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Volcanology, hosted by Sam Mitchell and produced by Hugh James with Anturus Education. This series was supported through the American Geophysical Union's Sharing Science Program, and you can catch more of our episodes and information on our guests on our website, www.volcanknowledge.com or follow us on social media at Volcanknowledge through Twitter and Instagram.